Chapter 9. ST. Seattle Aquarium, Seattle, Washington, USA. I said I'd tell you everything, so I have to be totally honest here and tell you that I shit myself. I was full of beans, literally, and I crapped myself right there on the weird-ass tank. It was the first time since the eyeball incident that I was relieved Big Jim wasn't around. That would have been mortifying. But I had more pressing things to worry about. I couldn't find the body that went with the eerie voice. I hopped nervously, trying not to jump in my own excrement. "Who are you?" I asked, and then followed up with the more pressing, "Where are you?" Dark water near the rock pool started to stir. The sea stars were screaming at this point, and an arm, long and rust-red, lifted from its depths and into the air. The elongated arm suctioned itself to a rock and was followed by several more lissom limbs, which danced together to lift an enormous, bulbous head from the depths. The octopus's skin suddenly changed color and texture, muting the autumnal red to a blur of shimmering silver shadows that looked like scudding clouds. My chest thumped hard, wings of my heart aflutter as I watched the giant cephalopod emphatically maneuver itself onto the rock pool structure, reaching out one arm to suck up a terrorized sea star into the folds of its underside. I caught a flash of massive paper-white suckers at the thick base of its arms. The sea star gave a gallant cry. "It is my time! Our freedom is finally here! Let us be gone from this terrible place!" The repressed sea star legions cried out in delight. "You are all next, stars of the sea! The view up here is..." After some tense and awkward minutes while the sea star was ingested, the regularly red predator and I looked at one another. Dark, shiny crow eye to horizontal pupil shaped like a black smile.
"So, here you are."
The rippling, puckered skin across its colossal melon was captivatingly bumpy, glistening. And as I watched it, the texture changed again, an effortless magic trick. Suddenly it was smooth and glossy.
"I think you're mistaken. You think I'm somebody else," I said to the Leviathan in front of me.
Giant Pacific octopuses live up to their name. This one was the size of Big Jim's meat freezer. I watched a suctioned arm stretch out a good 15 feet into the air. The black smiles studied me.
"You've come for answers."
"Well, yes, but it's not like that's particularly specific to me. I'm pretty sure all of us have questions about..."
"You straddle two worlds, and you have lost your reason for being, your way."
"Yes, but again, that could be said of the sea star you just snarfed."
"You are a crow who believes he is human, one who has befriended a taciturn bloodhound. You have lost your connection to the world of man, and you have come all the way from the Ravenna neighborhood, where you've been hiding in a small craftsman home, to ask me what happened to mankind."
"Right," I said. "That seems more specific." The octopus thrust a limber arm into the pool and fished out a small rock, which he rubbed rhythmically against stone. The scraping sound was at once sharp, repellent, and oddly hypnotic. Questions flew from my heart. "How do you know any of that? How can you possibly know anything living in this place? Living in this tube tank?" I asked, tapping my leg on the top of the glass. "You must know aura. Are you Onida?" The octopus held time in its sucker-smothered arms, speaking in an orotund voice.
"I am Onida, and I've known about you for a long, long time. Your world is small, crow."
"Shit turd."
"Excuse you?"
"My name is Shit Turd, ST for short." A frown furrowed the wrinkled skin above the hooded black smiles.
"It's time to expand what you know, crow. I do know aura. But there is not just aura in the world. Your crow kind absorbs through aura. My kind, those beneath the breathing line, those of scale and shell, we listen to echo, the ocean's breath, the song of whales, the hum of a mollusk, the swish and sway of kelp. It is connected to aura as all things are connected. I listen closely to the messages of water, air, and the other world, and beyond that which we can see.
Onida slithered closer, still on the rock, a colossal peristaltic mass of muscle. What sickness do the mofos have?
I don't understand your question.
The humankind. What has happened to humankind in Seattle?
Onida suddenly flashed a luminous pale gold, the ridges of his skin smoothing and rippling pink at the edges.
Humankind is changed. They have denied the law of life by taking too much and are facing their consequences. The one who hollows as well must return.
What can we do to help them?
Onida searched the beamed ceiling with those horizontal pupils.
I must tell you that it is not just Seattle, Crow. It is across the whole. Mankind missed the essential calling to evolve. You are watching their extinction.
No! I squawked, scaring myself. Then I gagged and vomited up a river of coffee sludge. My Gueuler fluttered in panic. How could this be? No. No, 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 no. You are wrong, Octopus! No, I know you are wrong. I heard them fighting. I heard bombs in the distance. They are out there.
What you heard were the fires and explosions, the final words of the things they made. Here and there, all over the whole, there have been and will be the last explosions and fires, destructive things that make destructive ends.
The room swam. I stumbled, toppling down to the murky depths below, catching myself last minute with frantic flaps and returning to the top of the tank. And here's what I thought of. Hot dog eating competitions. One of Big Jim's favorite things in the whole wide world. Every 4th of July, before beer, fireworks, and Jägermeister, we'd tune in to ESPN to watch the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest at Coney Island, emceed by the irrepressible George Shea. And I tell you, it was impressive. These magical mofos of all sizes and backgrounds, like 11-time champion Joey Chestnut, or Megatoad, or the leader of the Four Horsemen of the Esophagus, Sonia Thomas, would get announced by George in inventive ways. He'd introduce a contestant as the David Blaine of the Bowl, the Evil Knievel of the Alimentary Canal, the Houdini of Cuisine, Crazy Legs Conti. We watched him present the Salvador Dali of the Deli, the David Bowie of the Bagel, the Liberace of the Lunch Line. Some of these master eaters were a quarter of the size of Big Jim, and we'd watch them lube up slimy Nathan's natural casing wieners in water, and when the buzzer went off and the crowd was in a frenzy, they'd slip those suckers down their gullets at lightning speed. These incredible athletes would put a pelican to shame. It was a thing of great fucking beauty.
You are watching their extinction.
There would be no more hot dog eating contests, or NASCAR, or picnics in the park, or Cheetos, or America's Funniest Home Videos, or revving truck engines, or books, or children laughing, or fetch with a stick, or iPhone updates, or shopping, or electrical jobs, or songs, or genius inventions, or drunken dancing, or fireball whiskey, or snow globes, or wedding vows, or ugly ties, or Christmas hugs, or families. Family. And there would be no more Big Jim. I felt the aquarium tighten, the water level rise. I was collapsing. The octopus erupted into electric blue spots, and I focused on those, not on the terrible, terrible thing I had heard. One thing was certain. I wasn't going to tell Dennis about this. It would kill him, and I'd made it my mission to keep him alive. I'm sorry, I told Onida. I don't usually have this little control over my bodily functions. I thought of Dennis and his dark depression.
Where I come from, we call what you're feeling the black tide. It will pass. Tides, by their nature, come and go.
As the octopus spoke, I felt my blood flow slowing. He gingerly ran his suckers across the rock as if to taste it. I said, what if there's something that can change them back?
It is not known.
Or what happens if they just stay in that state of sickness? Just wander around really gross, but still alive? I bargained with the one searched for.
The part that made them human has flown away, Crow. What is left is a broken shell, uninhabitable. A crab must always find a new home. Mankind will now destroy itself until there is nothing left. They exterminated the most real part of themselves first, and now their complete physical disappearance is prolonged and inevitable.
I flashed on the fleshy, pulsing lump Dennis and I had seen. My God! It was a sick mofo in its last stage on Earth, facing the last stand before extinction.
It is balance. It is how life gets back what was taken. The humans are dying, Crow. Which means a part of you must die, too.
Stop calling me Crow! Oneida erupted into a light show. Electric blues and neon flares swam across his skin, his arms rippling with emotion, a gorgeous and deeply disturbing dance. Something about this display slowed my pulse.
You must reconcile with yourself, Crow. Your life depends on it.
What the hell does that even mean? I scraped at the tank with my foot. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude. It's just a lot. You don't know how hard it's been since Big Jim got sick. Inside, I told the giant Pacific octopus, a creature I never imagined to see in three dimensions, unless Big Jim won the lottery and bought an IMAX theater like he'd always planned. Oneida lifted an arm, balancing on his two suctioned legs and five other arms. His movement was mesmerizingly fluid, otherworldly. The raised arm was severed three-quarters of the way down, tinged with blue blood.
Never presume to know the journey of another, friend, he said.
I bowed to him, a sign of respect in Crow I'd never, ever performed before. I have no idea where that shit came from. But how did this happen? How did the sickness start? There must be...
It doesn't matter, does it? This is what is. This is a new world. Self-regulation in play. It is not my answer to give to you. What matters is that you have a choice, Crow. Your kind need your help.
You said I can't help them.
The domestics. They are the others who straddle both worlds. Other birds. Dogs. Turtles. Cows. Goats. Sheep. Snakes. Rabbits. And yes, even cats. The domestics are the last of your kind. And they will be the very last of mankind's legacy. Buildings are crumbling, paper is disintegrating, mold and bacteria are quiet conquerors, and the soil is claiming back what is hers. The forces of the whole have been contained and controlled for too long, and when those who break free from their cages do so, they will not do it quietly. Humankind's stories in paint, and ink, and machine, and structures that reach for the sun, they will all go. What is left is you. Millions of domestics have died, but there are still many, many more, stuck and abandoned and looking for a savior. Growth and evolution depend on our changing relationship to the beings around us. If you want to help mankind, this is what you must do. It is your choice, Crow.
Domestics? I puzzled over the idea while simultaneously noticing how enjoyable it was to converse with someone who didn't have the brain of a chicken nugget. I was finally, perhaps for the first time in my life, being heard. I let myself ponder the concept before saying, "You know so much, Oneida."
I have 9 brains, which never stop growing, 3 hearts, and I can regenerate my arms, but mostly it's because I'm female.
Female? Well, shit. Admittedly, I had limited knowledge of them, but they had always seemed omniscient and formidable to me. An erect blade cut through the water below, fast and determined. It was the color of a sky pregnant with a deadly storm. A fin. Oneida's arms and legs twisted and coiled on themselves, one squeezing tightly as if to crush a quarter in its clutch. A tight shiver rippled through her muscular mass. "What are you going to do now?" I asked Onida, beak pointed at the water.
"I'm going to eat, and then I'm going to leave. You should get going, Crow. You have choices to make."
I kept a beady eye on the fin as it circled around the tank on which I was perched, Shark Week flashbacks blinding me. "And after that, what's next for you, Onida?" I asked in a flat tone, weary and stunned from all I'd heard. I had other questions, but they wouldn't form, stuck and gluey in my head.
"I'm going to return to the ocean, mate, and die," she said, pride swimming through her words.
I stared at the wonder of her, this fluid miracle, free from the burden of bones. Her arms undulated with excitement, dripping into the molasses dark water. A mystic about to prey on the most feared aquatic predator, ocean's sharp-toothed bullet. "That sounds fucking terrible," I squawked, imagining a many-limbed snuff film.
"Everyone has a journey, Crow, more than just the one."
And I think she winked at me with a black smile. Chapter 10, ST, Outside Seattle Aquarium, Seattle, Washington, USA. Since it was relatively quiet around this section of Alaskan Way and darkness was spreading its velvety wings, unimpeded by a single street lamp or headlight, I rode Dennis under the Alaskan Way viaduct and found a spot that looked like it had been a camp for a homeless mofo. Big Jim and I knew a lot of homeless mofos from our various adventures together, and we gave them dirty dollar bills and fireball whiskey. Big Jim said they served their fucking country and in return got told they were trash, and they must have believed it because they were always ferreting through the dumpsters. It wasn't a perfect shelter, but with the vines and English ivy hanging down in limp sheets from the enormous concrete structure, it would do us for a night. Dennis even used his unparalleled snuffer to track down a bag of Fritos ingeniously stashed in a removable concrete block, which he pawed loose. We shared them in the blackness, though I confiscated the accompanying small bag of heroin. Dennis still wasn't tremendously stable. Minutes later, Dennis was doing his ritualistic series of pirouettes and coiling himself into a tidy ball on a pile of wool blankets. I watched him closely from my perch as he snored gently, his fawn body rising up and down, wondering how he could get to sleep so well without the rumble of a TV. His wound looked a hell of a lot better. Scabbing had started, but he certainly wouldn't be winning Best in Show anytime soon. I suddenly thought of the only other non-mofo I was able to stomach being around. Gubari was an African gray, a bird who could count and do perfect impressions and articulate a dictionary of mofo words, a creature whose crackling genius so closely aligned with his mofo owners, he filled me with envy. I ruffled my feathers, shaking off the thought of Rohan, Gubari's kind mofo who had taught Big Jim how to take care of me when I was a leaf-skinned nestling with cornflower blue eyes and a sugar-pink mouth. Back when I believed tiny mofos lived in traffic lights and clouds were flying cotton, I didn't dare imagine what had happened to the African gray and his owner after Gubari had sent me the aura message to stay inside my house. I just couldn't swallow any more sad thoughts. Dennis started to dream through snorts and thin whistles and a kick that whipped off his starchy blanket. I dropped down and gingerly covered him. I studied Dennis's breath and its vibrant clouds in hopes that he dreamt of better days, perhaps of when we'd play chase around the Green Mountain sugar maple in the yard, a rambunctious game of tag where I'd pull his tail and he'd lope after me with a goofy smile, wrinkles lagging behind him. Big Jim watched over our frolicking, calling us a couple of goobers, and even the Green Mountain sugar maple and the Crocrosmias would shake with laughter. I missed the Green Mountain and its sweet voice, and how it erupted into the colors of a Caribbean cocktail come fall. I missed our tree in our home, how it would bleed sap when it recalled memories too painful to share because it knew that holding things in is toxic. I hoped that Dennis was dreaming of those days. I lulled myself by reliving those moments, feeling the kiss of dandelion cotton on my wings as I tagged Dennis, "You're it!" and falling asleep to the sugary tones of the Green Mountain, saying, "Renaissance, Renaissance." I woke before Dennis, breathlessly watching the sun rise and baptize the skyline in buttery tones. What an act of beauty, of unwavering faith, something to look forward to each and every day. Big Jim always said that nothing worth a shit pile happens before 9 a.m., but still, I wish I could have shown him this. As beautiful as the sunrise was, my heart was a boulder in my chest that would make it hard to fly. All the winged, even fungus gnats, know that you cannot fly if you're carrying too much weight with you. It's a well-known adage, actually. The light of heart is free to fly. Woodpeckers inscribe it into a lot of trees, those vandalizing assholes. I missed the sounds of Seattle, the percussive rhythm of people, the clicking of heels, the throttle of an engine, the throb of a subwoofer, the siren song of an ice cream truck, the babble of caffeinated conversation, how I had to cock my head to digest a different accent, and boy, did I miss the invigorating chucka-chucka-chucka of a chopper tracking down a sneaky mofo. Lawnmower and motorbike and Beyoncé, oh my! I missed tidy, fresh-cut grass. All this long, tangled turf and greedy green devouring buildings made me nervous and also made an excellent case for the Homeowners Association's strident rules. Moss, especially the Spanish kind, is a deadly conquistador, dampening the sounds and edges of the city right before my eyes. Mofos kept a tight order to things, the world cupped in their hand, squeezing when necessary. I thought of the Green Mountain again, about how Big Jim had to trim it yearly to stop it from taking over the yard, and so one day it didn't fucking fall over and crush our house like a can of Coors Light. Our house belonged to Green Mountain now. Maybe that wasn't so bad. Maybe Green Mountain deserved it the most. Though Seattle had lost its beat, it had gained song. A charm of finches called out on Aura, speaking of a pending meeting at a swimming pool in Bellevue for communal bathing and where the one who spits was, with a warning to avoid him. A white-crowned sparrow squatted on the viaduct ledge brazenly close to me, a bossy little so-and-so, you know the type. He belted out a lively ditty about believing in oneself, which he obviously had zero issues with, the air cool enough to see the notes dancing from his songbird throat. That monumental show-off. Psh, singers, am I right? Satisfied he'd shown me up, he darted off, and then a creature I couldn't identify bellowed, and it sounded like, ho, 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 and Aura fell silent. I used the time to do some anting, a sort of manscaping I perform by rubbing pulverized ants all over my feathers to make them shiny and, ironically, keep insects off me. As I waited for Rip Van Wrinkles to awake, I thought about the other Dennises out there. How many more of him were there? Creatures who'd been loyal and good to the mofos. Creatures who depended on them for water and love and milk bones. Creatures who, like me, hadn't been born in the wild and didn't know the law of life. Creatures with scales or bristles or down, slobbering tongues, good hearts, gentle souls, and soft mouths. Creatures who knew the magic of mofos, what they give us in protection and affection, what it means to love them with all of your heart and nose and beak. The feeling of those funny, bald fingers that can open books and cans of refried beans gently sliding down your back. Mofo is family. Onita was brilliant, the oracle of the ocean, but I couldn't believe everything she said. I couldn't believe in my heart that there were no mofos out there, that some hadn't hunkered down somewhere and kept their necks straight. I had hope, and feathers know that hope is the very thing that allows one to fly. I thought of the dirty minivan on I-5 South with the superhero family decal on it. That's what it was all about, being together and saving the world. When mofos and the furred and feathered worked together, it was beautiful and unstoppable. It was what nature intended. I was thrilled when Dennis woke up. Turns out it's very dangerous to be left alone with your mind. And, without Seattle's beatbox, I was really hearing mine. Dennis was less thrilled. He leapt to his feet, hairs bristling up the ridge of his back. He sniffed at the sun and back down to the ground, pivoting and shifting his weight. A rumble released from his throat. Something was wrong. I didn't have time to ask him what. Before I could shake off the remaining ant carcasses, I saw the cause of his anguish. they emerged from a multi-layered parking structure, trotting toward the viaduct, toward us. I launched high to get a better look. I counted 8 of them, which is lucky since I can only count to 9. I didn't like how all their weight was forward, tails and ears standing to attention as they cautiously neared us. To them, Dennis was guilty until proven innocent. The pack encroached, blatantly disrespecting the boundaries of territory and personal space. Bringing up the rear, some sort of mutt, rangy as a setter with oil-slick fur and a long-legged white mongrel, mud-caked and mischievous. A black-and-white dog with border collie and battery acid in him slunk in front of them, his nose intermittently tightening into a snarl. A terrier and a brown-white pointer padded in front of them, tailing identical brindle dogs and one very large, sinister flea bag that resembled an African social weaver's nest. In front, a German shepherd mix skulked forward. A gray scar swam angrily down his muzzle, and next to him, the muscle, a rust-colored chow, blue tongue hanging like a dead lizard. Oh, shit, I think that might be 10. Or 13. I told you my counting sucks. I started to panic. I could tell because I was bouncing in place, perched high on the viaduct. Dennis stood his ground, guarding his only possessions in this new world, the mass of smelly blankets and an empty packet of Fritos. I launched into the air, scanning my eye view. Escape. I had to find an escape route in case this interaction went south. The mofos at Pike Place weren't far off, and I couldn't risk luring Dennis toward them, so I had to figure out something better. A bevy of black-tailed deer caught my eye, grazing on a thicket of brambles below. To the gentle grazing. That's where we'd head. I lowered and got the shock of a lifetime.
This isn't your territory.
Wait, what? The German shepherd was so articulate, so eloquent.
That's mine.
The chow gestured to the urine-soaked blanket. I stared, slack-beaked, at Dennis. Nothing. So I did a quick check all around me, almost blown out of the sky by the cosmic skullduggery I was experiencing. Of all the dogs in all of this supposedly round ball the size of, like, 1,000 Seattles, I got stuck with the only one who speaks almost entirely through body language? The Tarzan of the canine world? You've got to be fucking kidding me. This, and we were about to initiate World War III over the planet's shittiest blanket? Dennis's lack of response and general staring in a bow-legged, provocative stance incited a symphony of growls. Not good. Not good at all. The chow and shepherd inched forward. Hey there, fellas, I said to the encroaching canines. Let's be civil about this, all right? Let's talk about this man to man.
He has my blanket, said the shepherd, flashing milk-white fangs.
I'm confused, I said. Is this your malodorous blanket, or the chow's? The shepherd's bark could cut through skulls. He snarled, a final warning. All right, I said. How about we give you the blanket and get on our way here? No harm done, right? Dennis showed no indication of moving away from the blanket. Have I mentioned that hounds are stubborn?
Give. Me. The blanket, came a rumble from the chow.
Dennis, you heard him. Step aside, I said with a shake in my voice. Dennis didn't budge. He just stood there like a witless wonder, but I knew he knew exactly what was going on, and he just wasn't about to relinquish a rag that was so plentifully bestrewn with mildew and smelled like French cheese. Listen, you guys, how about we talk about what's been happening in the world? We can work together. Imagine how strong we'd be. How long have you been out here as a pack? Did you guys have owners? You there, Shaggy, I see you have a collar. What's your story? I was stalling.
You a weak dog, said the chow to Dennis. Remove yourself from the idiot bird's command.
Idiot? I asked. Seriously? Are we... Never mind. If you all could just back up a little and give Dennis some space, then I'm sure he'll gladly give you...
You are doomed,
spat the chow with a flash of tongue, dark purple in the shadow of fangs.
You are nothing without a pack. You will die because of this black bird.
The pack inched forward, muzzles lowered. Dennis released a string of drool. I had to do something before they ripped him to shreds. The collie's nose wrinkled, a blue tongue retreated behind white canines, and that was enough for me. I plummeted beak first like a supermarine Spitfire. I mobbed those fuckers. I dove at the chow first, snatching a beak full of his fluff and spitting it out midair as I shot at the shepherd. The muzzle with its gray scar swiped my side as I snatched his tail and pulled hard. The dogs lunged, the pack circling me. I shot upward to safety with loud cries of, "Liberty or death!" I careened back down toward the giant shaggy nest monster and body-checked him, coming in feet first and bouncing off the collie, who was a hurricane of black and white, fang and fur and fury. I was Bruce Lee of the fucking sky, wings and feet and lightning, but the pack wised up fast. The collie, setter, white mongrel, and the brindles all snapped at me, lunging in the air. The terrier was feisty, but too short to catch the black bolt of badassery darting above. But now my pokes and jabs and fur snatching were no longer keeping the real threats, the chow, the shepherd, the pointer, and the shaggy a-hole, from slinking toward Dennis. I had to lure him away. I was just opening up my throat, preparing to call Dennis, when he bolted. Dennis shot down the underside of the viaduct, dodging cars and shopping carts, dead rats, bloodstains, and the twisted fingers of brambles racing past the Highway 99 Blues Club and Seattle Antiques Market, with me flapping hard to keep up with the pack hot on his heels. He burst from the viaduct and onto Alaskan Way, nails clicking as he ran, ears like wings in a blizzard, passing Ivar's Acres of Clams and the Seattle Fire Station 5, veering into the open-air parking lot of the Seattle Ferry Terminal. He weaved in and out of Chryslers and Lexuses and Corollas, all of it too fast for me to stop him. The dogs all skidded to a halt. I treaded the air, flapping my anxiety. What was happening? Next to the gargantuan wheels of a semi-truck whose head was buried deep inside the toll booth it had smashed into was a white dog with beige patches. An American pit bull terrier. She cowered next to the wheel, pink nose lowered, her hind leg quivering, which made the pink collar around her neck tinkle out a haunted jingle. Her tail was hidden, tightly tucked between the pink skin of her jittery legs. And though she was entirely not my flavor or species, she was a very nice-looking specimen who happened to be in the throes of heat. The pack dropped their beef with Dennis and started that well-rehearsed skulk toward the delicate white canine who licked her lips on loop, eyes flicking back and forth. Terror filled her soft hazel eyes before those trembling legs shot her away from the truck and down the empty freeway, disappearing farther into a precarious future. The pack thundered after her. Sinister barks echoed. Exhausted, I slumped onto the top of a butterfly bush that erupted from the cracked pavement, peering down at Dennis. He flopped onto an exposed slab of warm tarmac, panting. I hopped down next to him to inspect his condition. He seemed fine, that resilient fucker. I felt relief that we both were still sucking in air. This half-mute murderer would see another sunrise. And then came the anger. A jolting, acerbic anger that made blood rise to my head, pumping a furious baseline. That feral pack of dogs were probably at one point beloved companions, well-fed friends. And here they were, reduced to thuggery, no better than a gaze of ruffian raccoons. Common thieves, bullies, scoundrels. Is this how we pay homage to our mofos? To the ones who taught us how to be in the world? How to live our best lives and be as comfortable as possible at all times? I felt for the poor, pretty little American pit bull terrier who had a name and had probably been waiting all this time for her mofo to find her. And now we all knew what would happen to her. I'd seen it go down in a few of Big Jim's more populated pornos. I felt a powerful pang of relief that I wasn't female. It seemed that being female meant to be prey, even among your own species. All of it made me think of Dennis's testicles. Whoa, geez, not like that. You see, when Dennis was young and basically an ottoman of folds, Big Jim went to the vet, complaining about the amount of action his right leg was getting. The vet advised Big Jim to have Dennis neutered. Big Jim kicked up a calamitous fuss about this, declaring it an assault on all manhood. He punched a feline leukemia pamphlet display onto the vet's shiny floor and stormed out. A week later, legs swaddled in vulcanized rubber fishing pants, he returned and ordered Dennis's huevos to be rancheroed. All this time, I had thought it a bit barbaric and felt vindicated in not having dangly bits. But here we were, breathing, murder intact, because of this decision. Clever, forward-thinking mofos. Because he's modified and civilized, Dennis wouldn't desert me to chase some tail. Enough was enough. Onita was right. I wasn't going to sit here and do nothing while the domestics rotted away or turned into a bunch of brutish buttholes. Mofos made laws against this sort of behavior for a reason. I was going to step up and do the mofo thing. Take responsibility and bring peace to a world that was falling apart without them. We were losing what makes us human. Losing the very best part of us. Even if what Onita said was right, that the part that makes the mofos human has flown away, well then, what made me human was here to roost. I would not watch the spirit of a species wither and die. I was going to take back the world and restore it to its glistening glory and take a stand against the bears and the sick mofos and the wild dog packs. I was going to find my allies, the domestics, and give them back the world they knew. But first, lunch. Dennis and I raided the subway at the ferry terminal, the building gauzed in the castles of spiders who cherished its cool shade. We found the windows busted, the cockroaches celebrating, and the bread to be suspiciously well-preserved for its age. Dennis carried two loaves for us to enjoy, dragging them over to the water's edge. I dunked my portion in the water for an easy swallow and a touch of seasoning. We took in the view. A yellow crane lay still like a fallen giraffe, its neck broken and shattered. We admired Bainbridge Island across the water, a bouquet of trees guarded by the icing caps of the Olympic Mountains. We turned our heads right to see the Seattle Great Wheel, our city's Ferris wheel, alive with mofos, their twisted heads and spidery hands bent wrong at the joints, shimmying and swinging. The wheel used to be white. Now it was tainted by crawling, cadaverous bodies and their red slime, their violent endings. Safe at this distance, we tuned them out to enjoy the quiet view of Elliott Bay. There we were, a bear-mauled bloodhound and a crow covered in ant carcasses, not my best look, alive against all odds. We chowed down on Subway while watching a fairy, a creature of the utmost breathtaking beauty, her bold body a testament to the magic of mofos. The fairy, a powerful and indefatigable swimmer, was winter white with rims of forest green. She was called M.V. Wenatchee, and she was a beauty, even as the water roiled and bubbled around her, sucking her down, down, down. Even as she groaned under the pressure and beautiful parts of her snapped and cracked, I bowed to Lady Wenatchee, silently thanking her for her service. Mofos with sanguinary eyes and vacuous glares were clubbing their heads on her inside windows as her whole body, noble nose taking its last inhale, was swallowed by Elliott Bay. I said goodbye, digesting bread and big plans, my heart throbbing with purpose. Chapter 11. The Arctic Circle, Greenland. Meditations of a Polar Bear.
The ice is shrinking. My body follows its suggestion. These are not the bergs of my cub season. The ice kingdom is a mere shadow of what it once was. Now there is eerie silence and the drip, drip, dripping of ice as it sheds its tears. With every breath I call your name, Tornasuk, Tornasuk. I have scoured miles of the great white plains to find you, wondering if I am the last of the ice bears. It happened so fast. I called you to watch me hunt. My eyes were on the seal, glinting skin slick and thick. I could feel its oils, warm and rich in the stomach, a break from desperate pickings, rodent and berry and garbage. And then you were gone. Perhaps the waves took you, their appetite evolving from sea ice. We are all starving. and now I swim days-long stretches between sheets of ice, and I call for you. I swim until my bones drip, drip, drip. I am Seal's Dread, the huntress of the floe, the last of the ice bears. What is a mother without her cub? I will paint the snow with my paws and tear apart glaciers to find you. There is no earthly law that can stop me.
Chapter 12. ST. Somewhere alongside the Alaskan Way Viaduct, Seattle, Washington, USA. Guided by my instincts, Dennis and I started to trek south, and all the while I called out, waiting for a response. I wasn't getting a strong enough signal. Aura was silent. Where was the sprightly song of bird and tree, the voices that keep Aura alive? What had hushed the network? Instinct spoke to me through electric tingles that scurried across my skin. A predator can silence Aura. I didn't allow myself to dwell on what kind. We plodded on, eyes in the sky and a nose on the ground, hunting for movement, attempting to keep one step ahead of the danger we knew would come. Our goal? Keep moving until we made contact on Aura. Using my sharp mofo reasoning, I'd devised a plan, but only Aura could help me carry it out. We followed the Alaskan Way Viaduct south, shaded by the corpse of the 99, a dead freeway, not to be confused with I-5 South, the freeway of death. We heard odd sounds. That savage, supersonic call again. Ho, 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 ho! Bouncing off the concrete jungle. The area had a cold industrial feel. There were pockets of construction now abandoned, with bright orange warning signs standing guard like ghostly relics. Be prepared to stop. Detour. Men working. The forsaken district was full of corners and buildings for things to hide in, and damn it, I was on edge in this steely labyrinth of heebie-jeebies. When we reached King Street, I tried again, calling out to Aura. A question burned in my chest, and someone on Aura had the answer. Hello? Can anyone hear me? The Lego maze of steel and brick and metal stared down silently. I could tell we weren't welcome here, didn't belong. Why were there no birds around? London plains are tough urban trees that tell their stories over the drone of streaking cars and sound like they've been smoking their whole lives. Because they have. Dennis lifted up his black truffle of a nose at grizzled trunks. Their camouflage colors rose to a sulking sky. His droopy eyes scanned their mysterious shaggy crowns. A nervous whine escaped him. I gasped. The London planes were pointing with their branches, pointing north. Three of the trees made a hush noise.
Go back,
one of them urged. Holy donuts, why? I asked, but didn't get an answer. Are you really talking to us? Me and Dennis? Trees are taciturn. You can't force them to do or say anything. Their idea of time is different from that of other beings. Their philosophy is to exist in a steady and deliberate manner, slow as sap, as the spreading of roots. They don't rush anything, unfortunately for me. But we've just been there, I told them. I can't go back. I'm sorry. We have to find the birds to connect to all of Aura, and they aren't back that way, for fuck's sake. They didn't respond, just hushed and continued to point. Dennis stuck his nose in a mound of garbage, found half a tennis ball, a chunk of our old life, and lit up like a Christmas tree, bounding around and shaking it with his slobbering melon. Shh, I hissed at him. Simmer down, Dennis. His exuberant joy felt dangerous here, blatant as the bat signal. But Dennis was on cloud nine. Might as well have found Cheeto's headquarters or the mofo cure. Convinced I was going to have an embolism, I confiscated the slimy half-ball. Dennis whined, but then conceded.
Dennis, we're living in a different world now. This whole situation is a total soup sandwich, and I'm not willing to die over half a tennis ball,
I said in a hushed tone. As usual, Dennis took the disappointment pretty well. He's sort of affable that way. I still expected he'd give it one last try, attempt to engage in a game of keep-away, chasing me down for what was left of that shitty ball in that ridiculous seizure-inducing yellow, but then his nose caught on to a new scent.
Dennis stood erect, staring with his nose so finely tuned, I imagine he was smelling in pictures. Oh, no, not again. His snuffer was doggedly fixed, pointing ahead. I followed its aim down the stretch of King Street's smoky asphalt to a clock tower. The giant clock hands, stagnant and lifeless, appeared to have given up without the mofo's souls. I understood. As we pressed on, Dennis's body posture changed again, his trundle morphing into a careful trot. We were nearing whatever he smelled. The trees we passed were pointing back the way we came.
"The other way,"
they hissed. Dennis suddenly startled at a cluster of eyes that materialized next to him. I squawked in shock. Mofos, heads swaying, stretching out their rotting limbs, were inside what looked to have once been an oyster house. The glass windows were, of course, shattered and gaping, but metal bars had been erected to keep the mofos in. Or something out. Dennis quickened his pace to pass them, maintaining his focus on the unconscious clock tower ahead. I looked at the writhing mass of mofos, trapped birds in a cage, trying to make sense of the senseless. The sidewalk in front of the abandoned eatery was marked with green spray paint in hasty handwriting. Never enter. Never release them. A severed arm, slim and fish-white, lay near the locked gold entrance doors and a dusty happy hour sign. Its bluish wrist held a bracelet of bright emeralds captive. The fingernails, polished purple, clasped a napkin with a crude, hysterically written message scrawled across it. "Tell Peter John Stein I love him. Tell him, but do not use your phone." I looked at the bar's sign and lowered my head. There would be no more happy hours. There was nothing on the stretch of King Street to the clock tower but deserted bikes, cars, buses, smashed storefronts, and an uneasiness that made my beak chatter. The concrete fought with flora that burst from its body, green vines taking their sweet time with the conquest. I didn't like the silence one bit. Aura was still off. No signal. A dead zone. We approached the clock tower with reverence and quaking legs. The only movement was a sign below the clock face, hanging by its last corner and swinging gently. It said, "Amtrak." And then I remembered, yes, King Street Station, where Big Jim had picked up Tiffany S. from Tinder, and she'd said, "Wow, you're a lot fatter than in your pictures." Dennis started pacing again. He was making it pretty clear that we should leave, his zigs and zags painting an ominous tableau. We had found his smell. Then, the real crux of the problem reared its molting head again. The part of me that is Crow. I had to look inside. Had to know what had happened in the station where mofos had built an incredible machine that moved like a bullet and cut through the countryside like a flaming arrow. A train that went to Edmonds by the water. A place with salted caramel ice cream and art made with hands. And a bookstore that smells like woodland mushrooms. And to Canada. A place where Big Jim said we should never go because their bacon is overhyped bullshit. Dennis whined, a high-pitched plea to stop me from barging ahead in typical valiant ST fashion. I gave him a sharp nod of reassurance, hopped up to one of the doors, and flapped through the missing glass. I perched on an ornate brass light fixture. King Street Station had retained much of the beauty in its bones. Its carved, coffered ceiling, the shine of marble walls, the wood benches for mofos to sit on and wait for the train's shriek. But there were some notable differences since I was last here meeting Tiffany S. from Tinder. For starters, there was what was left of a mofo, a torso in a fluorescent yellow and orange jacket, squirming on the ground next to the tickets and information counter like a halved worm. The smell of recent death and fear pheromones dangled in the air, heavy as ripe fruit, and I quickly realized that the place was speckled with bones, a femur, a mandible, a smaller other leg bone. Admittedly, my anatomy identification could use some work. A sticky meat log with legs lay near a discarded backpack. I gasped at the grisly scene. It had been some sort of small animal, perhaps a dog, dachshund maybe, now denuded of its fur and skin. A fresh blood trail smeared itself across the length of the enormous lobby, defiling its large mosaic compass. The crow part of me just couldn't resist, couldn't let it go, couldn't heed Dennis's warning. And I fluttered from one light fixture to another to get a closer look at whose bright, freshly freed blood it was. I could make out a black body on its side. The smearing blood trail stopped underneath it. I dropped down to a bench next to the black body in order to get a closer look. The gorilla lay like a cheese curl, and I could see that most of its back was missing. A deep gurgle released from it, making me jump, and I saw its chest rise, a Herculean effort. I hopped closer, mesmerized by the deeply lined skin of its face, a gentle map, a bright round moon with pleasing features and lips that could form words and convey a library of expressions. Its bulging brow held history, lessons learned, pockets of sorrow. Its wrinkles told me stories. The white chin whiskers conjured a memory of the spiced, woodsy scent of shaving cream. A fire roared inside me, the urge to preen its sparsely fine fur. I fell deeply in love with its twitching hands, so beautiful and complex, with the wondrous joints and smooth, spongy skin of a mofo, briefly coiling as if to catch a thought, an idea, or to grip the whole world. The heartbreaking wonder of fingers. Then the gorilla opened its eyes, eyes that knew a lot of things I wanted to, eyes the limpid color of fireball whiskey. Those eyes registered me, reflecting back the clear image of an inky bird, a plucky, twig-legged investigator I didn't recognize, didn't connect with. The bird looked at me, darting and dauntless with shrewd swagger, so fingerless and feathered, I felt the sudden suffocation of shame. The gorilla sighed, and I watched the vital spark in its eyes take flight. It entered me. I felt it take up residence in my heart. The gorilla, a female, I was sure of it, exhaled for the last time. Her bluish, rubbery hand relaxed, body unclenching to send her soul airborne. An upward adventure. I caught my breath and came back to Earth. Wake up, ST. Something had mauled the gorilla, and another glance around the station made one thing clear. This was that something's den. It wasn't far away, and it wouldn't be gone for long. A trail of prints, perfectly captured in bright red blood on shiny marble, led away from the gorilla's fetal form and across the lobby floor. Big, bad prints that spoke to me in a particularly emphatic way, mainly saying, "Fuck off." I rose into the air and dove through the station, slipping through a glassless window and arrowing down to Dennis, whose tail erupted into air lashings as soon as he saw me. We bolted away from the station. Dennis's paws pounded the pavement, my wings set the wind free, and I called out to Aura for help, calling a name I'd heard before in Aura's song and sigh while scanning for biting things below. Sadness tugged at my tail feathers. I would have liked to have talked to the gorilla, learned its secrets and stories, and how it ended up in a train station in downtown Seattle, missing the flesh around its spine. I hoped my presence had at least provided a little comfort, because it had done absolutely fuck all to dispel our stereotype as the harbingers of death. Minutes later, we found ourselves at the mecca of Seattle sports fandom, a fishbowl of Emerald City hope, CenturyLink Field. Strange sounds echoed from its deep chasm. I called out. No birds responded, so I told Dennis to lie down under another London plane tree, three of her branches vehemently pointing north.
"Go back," she rumbled.
"We can't. Aura is this way. I can feel it in my feathers." The London plane was near a blue trash can with the Seahawks emblem blazoned on the side. I was comforted by its familiar Pacific Northwest Coast tribal design, said to be inspired by a Kwakwaka'wakw mask. Kwakwaka'wakw is my favorite word because it's easy for me to pronounce. A damn sight easier than rural brewery. A nap under the London plains would give Dennis a chance to rest and recover, but leaving him to do recon was getting harder and harder. Anytime he was out of my sight, I felt my blood quicken, and I had developed the nervous, derpy head bob of a damned pigeon. It was just me and Dennis in this spiky new world. A tiny but impactful murder. And murders are not something you ever, ever turn your back on. Every time he disappeared into the tall, unruly grass to do his business, I'd hold my breath. unable to inhale until his stupid, hangdog countenance emerged and he did that weird moonwalk grass-kicking ritual. This got pretty dangerous for me at times, considering how he peed in 3-minute streams like a goddamned Clydesdale. I shot up the side of CenturyLink Field and was hit by a dank, putrid smell as I hovered over its center, settling onto a metal edge of the stadium's roof. The scene was shocking. The sky frowned in dark clouds. Pigeons had painted the stadium's partial roof in corrosive white, which had mixed with the rains to form a hole-burning acid, but their empty nests lay soaked and abandoned. I wondered who or what had sent them flapping. The stadium had flooded, filled with a swampy green soup. A chorus of frogs harmonized in pulsing bursts like Dennis's squeaker toys. Vines and creepers hung from the stadium's sides, greedily smothering the bleachers, where I saw rogue bones and lost limbs, an upturned cooler, a muddy sneaker, part of a ball cap. Weeds and muck and fungus and creaky-legged insects had invaded, and the smell of batshit stung my beak. Rust was conquering the stadium's metallic structure. The suites collapsed and spilling brick guts onto the bleachers below. A decaying stench rose from the swampy soup, where mofos in algae-slick, numbered jerseys bobbed rhythmically in the watery depths. 2 helmeted mofos drifted close, then smashed their helmets together as if gripped by the cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs hormones of rutting season. Another mofo, mossy, muscled, and missing both a helmet and a head to protect, smacked its arms against the deep, wet murkiness. 1, with a number 31 on his back, clawed up the bleachers, red eyes hunting. Number 16 sprung like a flea to climb the face of the field scoreboard. Jerseyed bodies floated face down. I squinted from a high distance, distinguishing the rutting players as Wilson 3 and Sherman 25. These were Seahawks fans. I bet they'd known they were sick and cureless. They'd come here in their jerseys to await their fate. Their final choice. Loyal until the end. As a homegrown Seattleite, this caused a throbbing ache to hammer on the chambers of my space needle-shaped heart. A single sign prevailed. Home of the Twelves. The 12th man, meaning the Seahawks football fans, the symbolic 12th player on the field, cheering from the sidelines, loud as a jet plane. The 12th man, proud peacocks who flashed their blues and greens, had roared like animals and broken sound records and caused false starts and earthquakes and believed their way to Super Bowl victory. Big Jim and I watched every Seahawks game, squawking at the screen, decked in spirited blue and green garb. Nargatha knitted me a nifty Seahawks scarf that I was very proud of, even if Big Jim called me Nerd Bird when I was wearing it. Nargatha, whose family lived on the East Coast and sometimes forgot her because of New York minutes, often got lonely. She would come over during halftime and bring us a chicken pot pie while reminding Big Jim he needed to eat healthier. I liked how she would prod him in his belly, perhaps the only one who had access to his soft spot. And sometimes we would win, and Big Jim would set off fireworks in the yard, and Dennis would wet himself, and I'd tell the college crows to suck it as they dove for cover because I was a fucking phoenix. Big Jim would have given his right arm to have played here with the other 12s. I was glad he couldn't see what had become of our beautiful, glorious stadium, our team's loyal fans. One could only hope that in days past, they had smelled better. I suddenly realized that the croaking had stopped. Something had silenced the frogs. Something or someone, I wasn't sure. Concentric circles rippled from an origin point in the green, and I watched and waited, breath hitched. A sly sliver of dark broke above the water's surface. "Please be another mofo," I hoped, tapping my toes in terror. The circles stopped forming, larger ones dissipating and dying out. Wilson 3 and Sherman 25 continued struggling in the water, smashing their helmets together, oblivious of the new silence. The palpable threat. An eruption burst from the flood's surface, algae raining down. An enormous mass, a barrel of gray and pink, lunged and fell on top of the 2 players, jaws clamping down on Wilson 3. The splash sent debris flying, drenching the bleachers in putrid green rain. I cawed out, but what could I do to stop it?
As the giant mammal shook Wilson III from side to side, my eyes widened. I recognized the rounded ears, the wide-set marble eyes, the girth of a rubber-skinned beast that took up most of the TV screen when it showed up on National Geographic. A goddamned hippopotamus! I couldn't believe it! Couldn't believe that any of this was anything but horrible, hideous, Ambien-induced psychosis. How had he left the confines of his zoo habitat? A gorilla and now a hippopotamus? African animals roaming the city of Seattle? The cogs in my mind began to spin, ideas forming like clusters of clouds. A white streak of movement above me caught my eye, and I looked up to see a solitary gull cruising past. I launched into the air, calling after him, "Hey, hey, hey!" The gull turned his head mid-flight to register me.
"What's up?"
"I'm trying to make contact and I can't hear anything," I told him breathlessly. "I need to follow up on something I heard. I need to know,
Aura or Echo?"
he asked, tangerine beak slicing through the air. "Aura," I shot back.
"Follow me,"
screeched the gull in that water-skimming pitch of theirs as he flapped casually. He was a cool customer, seemingly undisturbed by the thrashing water, the bloody carnage below, the violent demolition by an African predator in a distinctly northwestern football stadium. I flapped hard to catch up and decided not to look down anymore. I tried to shake panicky thoughts about the hippo, an herbivore, I was sure of it, behaving like an insatiable carnivore. It must have been eliminating any suspected threat or competition. Either that, or it had made an exception to its vegetarian diet, which was altogether possible. Big Jim went on several Tinder dates with females who were vehemently vegan, except for bacon. The gull flew over WAMU Theater and Safeco, where the Seattle Mariners play, but I didn't look down. Couldn't look down. From the sounds that echoed from below, I knew the scene would be similar to the stadium, and I just couldn't. I didn't need to see to know. I caught up to the gull as a direct result of my crow curiosity disorder.
"You said Echo, too. Where would you be taking me if I wanted to get information from Echo?" "Depends on what you want to know."
Here, his chest filled with air, puffed proud, and for some utterly inexplicable reason, I felt calm.
"The bay, the ocean, the sound, wherever you need. I can do it all, crow friend. I can relay current events straight from Echo, too. That's what we do. Us, the terns, sandpipers, kingfishers, and cormorants, we are the connection between Echo and Aura. Bridge of sea and sky. It's a beautiful thing. Life, my friend, life is a beautiful thing."
"Oh, thank you. Thank you," I muttered, grateful for the help, as unexpected as it was. I would never again refer to them as schlubby beach pigeons. What he said next roughly translates as,
"It's cool, man. Everything's totally cool. You just keep on doing what you're meant to be doing. You are flying the good flight,
glaucous-winged gulls. Turns out they're unflappable." He flew east from there and I followed, enjoying the contrails of calm that came off him. It gave me a quiet, panic-free moment to think about the realization I'd put together from my encounter with the gorilla and hippopotamus in the urban jungle of Seattle. How I now had a plan for Dennis and myself. Despite my new sense of composure, I couldn't let my guard down. I was grateful to the gull, but I still didn't trust other featherds easily. They can be tricksters and bullies, and according to CNN, they might just slap you with a spot of avian flu. The gull touched down in a park with a spectacular view of downtown Seattle, freeways snaking around its periphery like a twisted noose. I stared at the city's skyline. Oh, how I longed to hear the blare of an impatient car horn, the malignant symptoms of road rage. How I longed for the wail of a siren, the roar of an airplane, the tinny voice at a pedestrian crossing. "Walk sign is on at all crossings." I'm sure at one point the park was very well preened with tidy flower beds and John Deere tracks. Now it was choking on an army of sharp-toothed brambles that smothered the land with their spiny talons. I spotted one patch of exposed grass, not as tall as the rest, and walked on it for nostalgia's sake. An earthworm rose from the soil, dramatically postulating about the great change, and how,
"She will show no mercy as she takes back what is hers, and that it is time for the great coming. the inevitable hostile takeover of her relentless hands. I ate him. I hopped on top of a sign that said Dr. Jose Reisel Park. The glaucous-winged gull perched on the roof of the park's barbecue shelter. I examined his perfectly ivory plumage and the shock of gray on his wings, the pale gray of a misty morning. His eyes, bright and yolky, had a calming effect. I had largely ignored the very occasional gull that flew over our house, aside from hurling an artful insult, begone pubic badger, or a Creed CD case at them. It had seemed so easy to dismiss them as floating French fry receptacles. I wanted to ask him about echo, about what it's like to hear the songs of the sea, how it feels to fly great distances. What does it taste like when you are so free you can follow the sun until it dips down into the ocean? But it was best to keep these wonderings to myself. Best to keep up barbed wire boundaries and focus on looking after numero uno. The trees are talking to you. Never seen that. That's cool. The gull nodded his head vigorously. Go ahead. Call from here. Everyone will hear. It's all perfect. He was so mellow that my nictitating membranes licked my eyes lazily. I cleared my throat and called out to Aura, speaking a name that had excited me since I'd first heard it whispered through the limbs of trees. Hello? Excuse me? I'm looking for those who know of the one who opens doors. Aura erupted in chatter, songbirds singing, charms of finches relaying my message, a murmuration of starlings taking flight to spread my query. And within some amount of time that I can't be sure of because I still didn't really understand time and none of the clocks worked anymore, I got an answer.